You are listening to the Wesley Seminary Podcast out of Wesley Seminary at Iwu. Your host today is Dr. Aaron Perry, Assistant Professor of Pastoral Care.
Hey friends, thanks for tuning in today for the Wesley Seminary Podcast. Today we are having Dr. John Drury. John is Professor of Systematic Theology at Wesley Seminary. He runs a great course called Theology of Prayer. And I had a few students that took the class, shared a little bit with me about it. And I thought this would be a great episode to have John on the Wesley Seminary Podcast. And when I asked him, he said, well, let's talk about prayer. So that's what we're going to talk about. Thanks so much for tuning in. Shout out to Cam Davis for his production work. And grateful to John for joining us today on this podcast episode. And thank you, listeners, for tuning in. I think you're going to enjoy today's podcast episode. All right, John, I'm going to spring this question on you. Are you ready?
No.
You're ready or not, here it comes. So what is prayer?
What is prayer? I've adopted a definition that's used by the Desert Fathers. It's passed on through John of Damascus into the West, and then it's quoted frequently by the medieval authors that I spend way too much time reading. They all use this phrase, the ascent of the soul to God. It's so simple. It's just three words in Greek, you know. The ascent, the upward movement of the mind, soul, self. There's different ways of translating. That's part of what's interesting about this definition, is thinking that through. So it's the ascent of the inner self, not just the body, but the self, the soul, however you want to conceive of that, toward God. So it's a directing of one's attention towards God, would be a quasi-modern dynamic equivalence. So what I like about the definition is it's still very specific. So it's not just, because if everything's prayer, then nothing's prayer, right? And yet we know there are a lot of things that at first glance aren't what we think of as prayer that in fact are prayer, not just prayerful, but prayer itself. There can be, you know, there are times when someone might say, you know, when I'm just playing music, even without lyrics, that's prayer for me. And sometimes when people say that as an excuse to not engage in other prayer practices, we've got a problem. But when they mean, in that my self is ascending, directing itself toward God, right? In some at least quasi-conscious way, well, then you have prayer, right? So it might have words, it might not, right? It may be with the hands clasped, it may not, you know, but I love that definition. I don't know how that hits you when I say that, but that definition, but it also has, I also noticed I quoted people to imply it has the authority of the church behind it. So, you know, if you don't like it, then
Aaron, you can disagree with this, but if you do, you're disagreeing with the Desert Fathers and St. John of Damascus.
I know, I played dirty. I did. Well, I actually, it's relevant though, because I mean, the way I think of it is that thinking, tradition reasoning means that the burden of proof lies on the one who seeks to revise. I don't think revision's impossible, but it does mean that if I want to have an alternative point of view, I need to come up with a good case and I need to give a fair hearing to the tradition. So if that is a standard definition, I think we should hear it and treat it respectfully and have good reasons to revise it.
Well, I think it's a posture of humility as well. And humility doesn't mean doing nothing. Humility in this case would mean specifically taking very seriously that which has gone before us and only out of that saying, do I think I could correct or strengthen or modify? And really with prayer, I'm thinking interestingly, the words that always come to mind are, Lord, teach us to pray, said by people who would have been praying, but something about Jesus that resonated in them, that here's one who can teach us to pray. And I think that when I'm thinking the posture of humility and looking back on what others have said, how others have practiced prayer, that we learn how to pray by being taught how to pray. I'm even thinking of my children. So we teach them to say grace, right? An attitude of just thanksgiving to God at meals. And so I have 8-year-old, 6-year-old, 3-year-old, and my 6-year-old is teaching my 3-year-old now how to pray. And we don't lose that spirit of teach us to pray as we get older. That should become really more and more conscious that, oh, I need somebody to teach me how to pray.
Yeah, and occasionally in life, you you end up bumping into by serendipity, providence, or desire and design, prayerful people, you know? And when you spend time with a man or woman of prayer, and if that stirs desire in you, then you find yourself going to them. And whether you put the phrase, teach us how to pray, whether you use that phrase or not, that's what you're doing when you seek to be around them more. You want to learn something from how to pray well, how to have a whole life of prayer. And back to your original question of a definition, you need a flexible enough definition to be able to recognize the great variety of prayer forms, because that's a key thing, at least has been in my life, and many have witnessed to this as well, that sometimes when the prayer life, there's different kinds of stagnation in prayer. And at least one form of stagnation is not, there's the stagnation where you've just quit doing it, and then finding a new practice actually doesn't help. That's just a fad, and you'll be back in the same place in 6 months. But the stagnation where you are practicing a routine, a rhythm of prayer, and it's just becoming a little dry, sometimes during that season, a new prayer form can be really transforming. Do you know what I mean? When you've always engaged in petition, right? Asking for things, to learn to lean in more into thanksgiving, just listing gifts a little more than asking for new gifts. That can sometimes have a shift in your consciousness as a prayer. Or if you have very wordy prayers, learning to engage in more silent prayer. And it's not that, you know, one is better than the other, but we tend to have seasons of life where we maybe need a new form. So if you've defined prayer in a way, like the phrase talking to God is good, I think it's a good definition, but it doesn't always capture some of the less talky forms that prayer takes. So if by talk you mean conversation with, or communing with, right? Communicating with. Okay, well, that you can communicate without words, right? So it doesn't have to have words, although it always will sometimes have words. There's never a church that is a completely wordless in its prayer may have lost something, but I don't know. I have to think about that.
So I've got kind of it's a two-parted question, but it's really just an observation then by a question. Okay. To key on a couple things that you said. I'm thinking of the person who is consistently talking in prayer, but they're no longer conversing with God. They're actually simply conversing with themselves. How that might happen. And then connected with that is what sets apart the person who is a person of prayer, as you described? How do you know you're in the presence of a person who is a prayerful person and not simply a person who's really good with their words, but is really only talking to themselves? What's the difference between those people, and how do you recognize it?
Well, that's good. That's a good question.
Hey, thanks for affirming my question, John.
Yeah, it's a delay tactic also.
I gave you a little bit more time to think about it.
That's good. I what's the difference between the ascent of the mind to God and just the curvature of the self in on itself? I put it that way because, I mean, there's this classic Augustinian definition of sin. Actually, Augustine uses it on the fly at one point, doesn't develop it. Anselm really picks it up and develops it. And the Latin term is homo incurvatus in se. The person, the human person curved in on itself. And that's kind of the essence of sin as Anselm explores. It's really brilliant observation. And it captures what is at work in so many different forms of sin. Whether in more prideful forms or more shameful forms, right? Like it doesn't have to be that curving in, and it's very much an image. I know this isn't good for radio, right? But you can almost see a person bent in on themselves, right? Navel gazing, as it were. Mm-hmm. And I'll never forget the moment when one of my prayer mentors said the phrase, introspection is not contemplation. And contemplation is not introspection. These are not the same thing. So a lot of times we think of a sort of contemplative prayer as a kind of entering into one's own thoughts. And maybe, but not, it's not a given that to talk to oneself one is in fact in conversation with God. So that was exploring your observation that yes, that there is a difference here. And now learning to discern the difference, even in oneself, is itself not easy, right? Is that's itself a key element in becoming a person of prayer, is learning how to tell the difference. And I think at the most flat-footed level, it's when you've had those occasional moments when you just intuitively sense that there was really a connection with God being established, and then the time, and then you, once you've had that experience, you now can tell the difference if you actually pay attention, you know. And it can be as simple as, I mean, a really good way to tell, actually, and it's not that the other's evil, it's just to recognize that it's just not yet prayer, is praying the Psalms, which is a big part of my own prayer practice. And by praying the Psalms, I don't just mean reading the Psalms or singing the Psalms or studying, definitely not just studying the Psalms, although all those are valid and can enhance, although they can also distract if you're not careful. Praying the Psalms, it's actually taking a psalm and praying it. Sometimes it helps to even sing it, kind of put it in some kind of rhythm of some kind. And I mean, every day I notice that there will be, usually it's psalm by psalm, there are certain psalms where they're someone else's words that wrote them, but I sense that I'm actually saying this to, I'm directing this to God. You know, I actually, there's an audience that I'm speaking to. And it's that, that's why that definition is so helpful now, as you can see. It pays dividends in this very question you've asked, ascent of the mind to God. I actually feel that sense of ascending, nothing special, nothing fancy, nothing magical really, actually at all. But just simply that that clear sense that, oh, these are my words and I'm speaking them not just to myself to make myself feel better, but actually saying it to God. But you know what? It's the majority of the time, it's just words on a page. You know, I've been praying the Psalms a long time, and still for me, majority of the time, they're just words on the page. And that's part of the practice, is the faithfulness to keep praying, right? Because if the moment a psalm is not clicking with me, I just put it down and stop. Well, that usually doesn't lead to more prayer in my life. It usually leads to less, right? So I've learned to trust that for me, regular reciting of the psalms, because you know what? And if you recite, you know, a couple psalms a day, and like one, or even just one a day, and like one verse really clicks with you, hey, that's prayer. That's better than nothing. That's better than nothing. And I don't want to go on too long, but I'll say one more thing. You can see how I'm moving in the direction of the key, really, in a conversation with God, is that if it's not just me talking to myself, it means at some point I'm also hearing and listening. And that always centers in the scriptures itself, not restricted to, but centered in God's own self-revelation. And that's why the Psalms are so helpful, because there are these prophetic moments when it's kind of God speaking to us, but most of it's our words toward God. So you have this sense of what has God already said? Am I listening to that and taking that as my cue as I speak back? So I'm actually speaking to someone who's spoken before, not just throwing words into the void, because to throw words in the void is the same as to just talk to myself. So that's a really good question what you're asking, and I don't think I've answered it sufficiently, but those are some of the rudiments on the way towards that question.
There are some people that, and you can get this wrong, but some people that I'm around that I think they have developed a sensitivity to reality that I have not yet. And I often think of them as people of prayer. I'm going to try and think of this back to what you just described. I was in a church, let's say over the last 6 months, and it was a worship experience. I'll use a friend of mine's words that was an assaulting of the senses. Yeah. There was lights and there was sound, and it was, the bass was like shaking me, and it was loud, and there was no way to be in it without feeling a sense of, without feeling it. There was no way to be in it without feeling it. Yeah. Okay. It was an assault of the senses. Now, I'm not trying to make a judgment of it for right or wrong. I'm just simply saying that's how I would describe it. And I was thinking, I wonder if there's a place in the practice of worship where we're trying to do precisely the opposite. We're trying not to engage the senses of sight, sound, taste, touch, right? Or to engage a spiritual sense, right? To engage our spirit. And when I think about a person of prayer, I think that's a person who whose spirit is developed. Their sense to reality beyond all the other senses that God has given us is acute, is attuned. It's like they're living in continual ascent. You know, it's like they can't come down. And when I think of a person of prayer, that's often what I think. Now, I've encountered people that my first impression was that's that kind of person. And it turned out maybe they weren't, or, you know, maybe their feet are still on the ground, so to speak. But then there's other times when I've encountered them, and over the long haul, they've revealed themselves that really is who they are by God's grace. So that's that was part of where that question was coming from, was what kind of sense is being developed in prayer, and is there a way to describe it outside the typical tangible senses?
Yeah, well, I kind of didn't even get to the second part of your question, and this helps me see what's at stake more in it. I mean, on one level, there's a hidden character to prayer life. I'm not saying it's not visible at all. But I know the element of surprise has been pretty crucial in my own journey of how surprised I am at the people who are who live lives of prayer. It's been going on for years unnoticed, and somehow through a variety of factors, I've come to find out that there's something there, you know? And now I don't mean to say that one can never talk about prayer as we are doing now publicly, you know, there's a place for teaching on prayer. But it's not a given that those who are gifted to teach on prayer are as prayer-filled as they wish to be.
Yep.
Now it would lack integrity and authority if one had no prayer life and one was going off talking about prayer. And you often can tell. Although the fact is I've heard some great stuff on prayer from people that I found out later don't pray too much, and they're good students and good teachers, and they were handing on truth that they themselves were not living. That doesn't mean that the truth wasn't valid. It wasn't valid for them, but it was valid for me because they handed it on. It isn't seen in public necessarily as well as, having said that, you know, you see sometimes someone will pray in public and you'll have that sense. They actually think they're talking to God right now. They're not just performing for us, right? Now, again, that's just a sense. And it would need confirmation. Do you really need to know? Because at the end of the day, if that inspires me to really talk to God in prayer, then isn't that good enough? Do I really need to know how legit they are? Maybe I do if I'm on some team that's deciding whether to put that person in charge of something. Okay, then yeah, there's some discernment that can happen. But it's always the discernment of spiritual senses, which does not result in empirical judgments. Well, we have these six factors. We know this guy's legit. Like you say, spiritual senses. And I think it's interesting that you use that language, assault of the senses, and the subtle contrast, though not absolute opposition, but subtle contrast with the phrase continual ascent that you used. And the fact it's funny because, of course, I have a relative positive judgment on assaulting the senses. And ironically, even for those of us who grew up in churches that assault the senses, and then we go into what we would think of as more contemplative worship spaces, like, you know, an old Eastern Orthodox church or something like that. But you're actually there during a service. You are assaulted by the senses, just different, very different ones. No, it's not the bassy kind. It's not the big lights, but the icons, the incense. There is an assault on the senses of a different sort. And it's very interesting of course, one very important difference is a lot of the senses assaulting that I've experienced in the evangelical churches is in order to direct our attention into one place, right? Some center or front area of a church space. And that's definitely the opposite motion that's taking place, like in an old Eastern Orthodox church where there's icons. If you want to just ignore the preacher and just look at the cool painting up above you, great. Whatever's getting your mind to assent to God, great, you know, is the attitude. And that's why it may be experienced as a more contemplative space, perhaps, because it's not grabbing you by the pole and saying, pay attention to me. It's saying, pay attention to God, and we've provided you many ways. But you're right to say that we need to sometimes be deeply understimulated in order to become attuned to the spiritual senses. I think that's the reason why the Desert Fathers went into the desert, because the desert is not as a sociological phenomenon. The desert is is a place of understimulation. That's what defines it. It's away from the crowds, away from the noise, away from the bustle. It's not silent. It's not even necessarily quiet. It can be, it depends. What's different is the senses are not being assaulted, but not because that's wrong, but because it forces us to like discover those spiritual senses as you named them. But having said that, when one is in continual ascent, you'll find a lot of people in continual ascent in churches that assault your senses, because it's not about the lack of human, about fleshy sense. It's beyond fleshy sense. So one can in fact be in ascent even as the physical senses are being bombarded. One, that can be an invitation, an opportunity for one to rise above into the spiritual senses. So I think some of it has to do with just different seasons of life, different needs, where one's at. If one's just, you know, yeah, anyway, I've gone on long enough, but you get the gist.
So we've come back to the Desert Fathers a few times, and I want to talk about one part of that and relate it back to prayer. Is that those who left the wider society in order to engage in lives that were often marked with solitude didn't do so because they didn't like people. Often did so because they felt that was the calling of God, that was their calling of God to engage in service on behalf of those people that they were often leaving. And I'm thinking of pastors, spiritual leaders in our churches today, and how easy it is to divorce our service of the people from our prayer lives. When often I think that we are called to, precisely spiritual leaders, pastors are called to pray on behalf of the people. That's part of the reason God gives them to the church, is to pray. Love to hear your reflections on that. It's so easy for pastors to... Let me change that. It was so easy for me when I was a pastor not to think of my prayer life as service to my people. Yeah. If I was serving my people, I need to be with them, doing something for them, you know, something marked, something tangible. So easy for me to divorce service to the people from praying for my people. Love to hear your reflections on that.
Yeah, well, it's a big factor in making time for prayer in one's rhythm of life, especially in pastoral life, is to say, well, I don't time, or they won't let me, you know, and that may have an element of truth in it, but it is based on, you know, a demonic lie that tells us that this isn't really the work that matters. Right. And because prayer is work, prayer is also rest. It's one of those weird things that has a strange relationship to the work rest distinction. You know, we associate prayer with Sabbath, but it's also a work. So it's kind of weird. You know, it's one of those weird transcendings of work and rest. But I think one thing that's helped me is to kind of see a certain kind of pattern. So I have a little diagram, which again, doesn't help on the radio. So I'll try to see how to get it captured verbally. So our everyday lives are, overrun with noise, right? With let's see, what is it? Noise, crowds, and busyness, right? So we're hearing and we're making and hearing noise all the time, right? words, you know, and sound all the time. And even just the hum of these lights, you know, above us right now, you know, there's even a lot of environmental noise that we're not attuned to, that we become aware of when we step away. And the crowds, you know, just being with just people bumping in, just needs all the time. And then the busyness, just activity, constant activity without, where the point is not always adding up and how's it all fit together, right? And so these three correspond to these crucial contemplative spiritual practices of silence, which is moving away from noise, solitude, which is moving away from the crowd, and stillness, which is moving away from busyness. But silence, solitude, and stillness are not ends in themselves. They're in fact the whole purpose of silence is a readying of oneself to hear the word, right? It's repentance. It's metanoia. It's turning away from the crowd, the noise, from the words to hear the word, right? It's an opening oneself up as well. And the same goes then for the crowds. You don't move into solitude as an end in itself. Even the Desert Fathers were very strict about this. Better a thousandth in love than one alone in hatred and inaccessible caves. That's a quote from Evagrius, right? It's better to be in the community and be a person filled with love than to be off in the caves filled with hatred and resentment, right? And Evagrius taught very explicitly, and it was standard teaching among the Fathers. He was just one of the first ones to write this down, that the key crucial blockage to moving into true prayer, right? The kind of prayer that is ascent of the mind to God and not just saying the words, right? True prayer, the thing that gets in the way is lack of gentleness, which for him means resentments, issues between you and a brother or sister, right? It's when you're harboring hatred, then you'll never have that genuine connection to God, which is fascinating that he observes that. And I think there's something deeply true about that. Because I know a lot of pastors who want to retreat into solitude or to silence, but it's merely just I want to get away from community. I want to get away from the burden of the word of God. I want to get away from the work, right? But actually, no, stillness is directed towards right action. When we are still, you know, we actually are having the clarity of purpose to know the thing to do rather than just the things that we do. It's in solitude that we are able to return to community, genuine community rather than just crowds, right? But actually, who am I here to serve? So this didn't answer your question directly. It's very indirect, but I hope you can start to see it. There is this pattern because there's a flip side to what you're saying. Because what you say, when you were a pastor, you struggled that you could only, your prayer life was really separated from your ministry. I had like almost the inverse mirror, but it was the same problem, just an inverse of it, where whenever I could only really get much prayer happening when I was praying for my people. Just enjoying prayer as an end in itself was very hard for me. Do you know what I mean? And same with studying the scriptures. As long as I was preparing a sermon, I could study the scriptures, but I didn't just love the scriptures for themselves, you know? But actually, ironically, loving the scriptures for themselves, loving prayer as just the highest activity of the human, actually makes you more equipped to pray for other people, you know, because you just enjoy doing it and you bring things up, you know, well, here's the needs in my community, Lord. This is what's on my mind. Can I share this with you? You know, so I think absolutely central task of the pastor is to be the one who intercedes for his or her flock. But that emerges through a rhythm of moving away from the crowds and the noise for the sake of the community, the word to be preached and heard. Anyway, that's my initial long, sorry, my answers are so long. Less work for you. You only have to prep like four questions to get through. Sorry.
Well,
prayer is hard when you're a wordy person.
Prayer is hard when you're a worrying.
A wordy person.
Wordy person. Prayer is hard when you're a wordy person. Prayer is hard when you're a wordy person. I'm gonna think about that, John. Joining us today is Dr. John Drury. John is a professor of systematic theology here at Wesley Seminary and friend.
And I've enjoyed learning from John about prayer. And so whenever we were thinking about, John, what are you going to say about this podcast? He just said, well, let's talk about prayer. And so I'm glad that we're doing that. John, we've just started to scratch the surface on some of this stuff today. Would you mind coming back another week and talking about prayer with us again?
Absolutely delighted.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. Friends, I hope that you've enjoyed this podcast. Check out some of the other episodes that we have published for you at the Wesley Seminary podcast. And be sure to tune back in when John comes to share with us more about what prayer is.
Check out Fresh Text too.
Absolutely. Fresh Text. A great name.
We even just had an episode not that long ago on Luke 11, the Lord's Prayer.
Yeah.
You were talking about.
Yeah.
So
absolutely. Check out Fresh Text, another podcast that John actually hosts, which has discussion of the upcoming lectionary text for the following Sunday. Yeah. So it's a great resource to pastors. And I hesitate to share this, but I had a student who recently asked me, instead of listening to the Wesley Seminary podcast, can I listen to Fresh Text episode instead? And I was like, absolutely not.
No credit for
Fresh Text. I let them do so after they raved about the name and how the name Fresh Text was just so meaningful to them. But listeners,
he's saying that because he came up with it. Let's make that very clear.
I did. I came up with it, and it's one of the few things that I feel like really proud about. It's one of my life achievements to come up with a Fresh Text name. Prayer is difficult when you're a wordy person, so maybe that this is a source of humility for me. Thanks, John, for joining us today. Thank you, listeners, especially for listening to some of my ramblings at the end here. Be sure to tune back in when John is with us again. Always want to say thanks to Cam Davis. Does a great job producing our episodes, and I really appreciate his support. Thanks so much for tuning in. Have a great day.
Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter under the name Wesley Seminary.